Good day, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Rapid Case Review. As today, we'll review actual cases of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. We're visited today by Dr. Matt Malowski from the University of North Carolina Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. In preparation for our program today, I met with two urologic medical oncologists, Dr. Nazli Dizmin from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and Dr. Jacqueline Brown from the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. And both of these physicians presented cases to me of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer that we're going to be discussing today with Dr. Malowski. All right, so let's get into the cases. Dr. Brown has a 56-year-old patient who she'd like some input on.
This is a 56-year-old patient of mine who is remarkable in a number of ways. He was initially diagnosed with locally advanced disease. He got neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy and progressed through it, was clinically declining at that time. We ended up foregoing cystectomy given progressive disease and development of lymphadenopathy, and he started on enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab in early 2024, so about 2 years ago. He had a rough go of it early on, got a dose, and then was actually admitted with confusion and found to have a new brain metastasis. He received a craniotomy and postoperative radiation therapy at that time. We resumed treatment. He's had more EV than most of my patients. He's on cycle 19 or 20. He has definitely, at this point, developed grade 2 neuropathy and had a prolonged break, about 6 months in 2025. We restarted after several dose reductions at 0.75, working our way down from the starting dose of 1.25 mg per kg. Another complication he had was a bowel obstruction requiring a diverting colostomy. Despite all this high-volume disease, brain mets, disease invading his bowel, surgeries to get around that, his scans now show no evidence of disease. He's a young guy. He wants his colostomy reversed. He wants to be as normal as he can be. He is asking, can I have that reversed? A surgeon is then asking me, can he have this reversed? How do you feel about his disease? I've sent circulating tumor DNA, which was negative recently, so that plays into my decision. And at this point, we're talking about, hey, we're almost 2 years out from therapy. When do we hold components of his therapy? So my questions with this case in terms of thoughts on management are, one, management of neuropathy with EV. I'm really curious about thoughts on how to best manage that, particularly in someone who's been such a great responder and is so young. How much EV is enough, particularly when you're dealing with neuropathy? I'm interested in your experience with brain metastases in UC. I don't see them a lot. When this happened early on in his course, I was very worried that this sort of signaled what would be a rapid progression to a bad outcome, and that hasn't happened. I'm interested in patients who have locally advanced disease causing bowel obstructions and then have this, you know, remarkable response experience with reversing that, particularly given all of the local complications we can have in UC from various, you know, thing. He may not have disease that's measurable, but he still absolutely may have fistula and other things like that. And then the role for circulating tumor DNA in the metastatic setting is a very big one in this case, and I want your thoughts on that. We know it's a useful marker in the postoperative setting with regard to risk for recurrence after cystectomy, but how should I be using it in the metastatic setting? Are you getting it regularly? Are you getting it in certain circumstances? Which circumstances? And then, of course, the big question when people have had a great response is, when can we say we hold treatment for both the immunotherapy component and the EV component?
So I told you you needed a notepad and a pen there. There are going to be so many questions. I got to say, too, that you know, these two docs presented a total of 16 cases to me, and this is the only one that had brain mets. So I don't know where you want to start, but maybe let's just start out with the brain mets, how often you see it. Is there any activity VV Pembro in breast cancer? We've seen pretty interesting activity in HER2-positive brain mets with T-DXd, another ADC. So any comments about brain mets about this case?
Yeah, you know, it's an excellent example of a lot of issues that we see. I think, you know, and Neil, you'll remember this. I mean, going back to the days of MBAC chemotherapy, when that was developed by Alan Yagoda and Cora Sternberg and Howard Schur, You know, what we saw is as we changed the natural history of the disease, we began to see actually brain metastases in a disease which historically had a much more limited life expectancy. That is, there wasn't a therapy that led to an overall survival advantage. And that change in the natural history of the disease led to us seeing more in the way of brain metastases. You know, I sort of wonder whether or not we are going to see more, you know, sort of atypical manifestations of metastatic disease in the context of therapy that's allowing patients to live longer. And maybe that is something to watch for with EBP. I think there's very limited data to date. I have had some patients who have developed brain metastases. I would agree with Dr. Brown. It's, you know, obviously very concerning when you are considering things like stopping therapy or consolidation, or in this case, colostomy reversal. And so I don't think we really have any data to understand what the natural history is and to help us to really make those decisions, certainly based on available data. And so, you know, my experience, again, is fairly limited with brain metastases specifically in this context. But again, I have seen sort of cutaneous metastases as an example in a patient who was on enfortumab for a long time with control of disease otherwise. And so I do think it's an interesting observation and something we need to watch for based on, again, that potential change in the natural history in the context of patients living longer with altered sites of metastatic involvement.
You know, this case, you know, with cell-free DNA being negative, which incidentally I'm curious what your thoughts are, brings up the thought that you're hearing more and more now in situations that used to be considered completely palliative, which is the possibility of cure. And I guess that we don't have enough feedback right now on EV Pembro, but any thoughts about whether we're going to see a tail on the curve there, which, like, for example, recently we've been noticing this in extensive stage small cell of the lung. They've got maybe 12 to 15% of people 5 years out. Or you think we're going to see this with EV Pembro?
Yeah, so we've seen it. You know, so in the EV-103 study using EV and pembrolizumab, the data for five-year survival has been presented, and it's about 41%. So this is, again, something like we've never seen before, you know, these sort of numbers. Are we curing these patients? I absolutely think that we are curing certainly a subset of these patients. And how best to select those patients? Well, ctDNA may be a way to do that. The data in metastatic disease is more limited. There have been series that have been published looking at ctDNA and being able to follow patients with metastatic disease. There have been investigators that have used thresholds of greater than 50% decline in ctDNA to be associated with time-to-event endpoints or clearance in ctDNA associated with an improvement in time-to-event endpoints. And so I think the future is going to be incorporation of ctDNA, and I am sending it. In what settings am I sending it? Well, I think one like this is certainly a very reasonable one. I mean, when you're considering sort of consolidative surgery in a patient, or in this case, a reversal of a colostomy in a young patient, or in a patient with brain metastases, again, not really understanding the natural history of the brain metastases in a patient like this, and the role of ctDNA specifically in that setting. I have to say, though, in this case, with the presence of brain metastases, I would have more pause in doing more in the way of aggressive maneuvers toward consolidative type surgeries or colostomy reversal. But I think that these are certainly the hot topics that we're all thinking about in managing patients with this therapy that has really just completely transformed the landscape.
What about avoiding local therapy to a brain met? We've seen this in lung cancer, for example, in patients with targetable lesions. They give systemic therapy, hold off on radiation. Do you think we may get to a point that way with something like EV Pembro, where if the patient doesn't have any neurologic symptoms, not that, you know, that maybe limited a number of brain mets, instead of treating locally, particularly if it's bilateral, you try systemic therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, you know, could there be a time when we begin to think more about that? I would say we're absolutely not there yet until we understand more about the natural history of brain metastases in this particular setting. It's quite rare, right? Even in metastatic urothelial carcinoma, in terms of presentation, it's going to be, you know, certainly, you know, maybe less than 2% of patients that actually have a presentation with brain metastases. And so I think there's a lot more to learn before we can do those sort of maneuvers. But again, I mean, you know, things are just changing so quickly. There's a lot of sort of retrospective large data sets that are being looked at to better sort out these type of questions. You know, so I think the future may hold systemic therapy as a potential treatment option, but I don't think we're there yet.
So we'll get to some of her other questions in terms of some of the tolerability issues of AV Pembro, maybe in another case. But one other issue I am curious about that, you know, this case brings up is duration of treatment, both the enfortumab and pembrolizumab. You know, this comes up on all these newer regimens that we're seeing great responses. Nobody knows exactly what to do. Sometimes you hear 1 year, some 2 years. Usually, you know, sometimes toxicity tells you what you have to do. But in patients who are tolerating therapy, you know, how are you going to approach or how do you approach when to stop?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a lot of hand waving in terms of what to do under circumstances like this. I mean, if you look at EV-302, which established the use of enfortumab, vedotin, and pembrolizumab in the metastatic setting, the median number of cycles of EV was 9, I believe, and the median number of cycles of pembrolizumab was 11. I think treating out to 24 months, you know, with immune checkpoint blockade is sort of a reasonable paradigm, and that's been established not only in urothelial cancer, but in other diseases as well. In terms of how much enfortumab, I think that, as you suggested, that's often driven by the toxicity profile. And that being said, you know, we have patients who do well with dose reductions and with dose holds and wish to proceed, understanding that their disease has been well controlled for long periods of time. So I don't know that I have a perfect answer to the question of exactly how long for enfortumab vedotin. Again, toxicity often dictates the duration of therapy, particularly as related to the neurotoxicity and peripheral sensory neuropathy. But I can tell you that I have had patients that are on for prolonged periods of time. I think it's much easier with the immune checkpoint inhibitor. So I don't, you know, I don't think there's a perfect amount of time. I gave you sort of the medians on the study, but that's in the context of a clinical trial, and it's not obviously the patient that's sitting in front of you with their comorbidities, with their toxicities as related to therapy, with their thresholds for tolerability of the individual agents or combined. I mean, you know, there's a lot to sort out, you know, with the data, but then obviously you need to bring it into the room and take care of that patient that's sitting in front of you.
So let's move on to our next case. And, you know, this could look like sort of a simple case, but, you know, in thinking about it, I cannot imagine presenting a case like this to you, like, say, 5 years ago. And it really talks about how we're really seeing a biomarker-driven approach to oncology in general, including urothelial bladder cancer. So let's hear about this 52-year-old man of Dr. Disman.
He was initially diagnosed with muscle-invasive bladder cancer in late 2023. He received neoadjuvant gemcitabine and cisplatin and underwent cystoprostatectomy with pelvic lymph node dissection. The final pathology showed high-grade urothelial carcinoma with micropapillary features, and the staging was YPT3N2. He subsequently received adjuvant pembrolizumab for a year without significant toxicity. Approximately 2 months after completing adjuvant immunotherapy, the imaging studies showed a new metastatic site in the left iliac bone and a 3-centimeter abdominal wall mass. Biopsy of the abdominal wall confirmed metastatic urothelial carcinoma. He was initiated on enfortumab vedotin. However, treatment was discontinued due to severe fatigue that interfered with his activities of daily living. The molecular profiling from the abdominal wall biopsy showed an FGFR3 R248C mutation and an ATM mutation, and the IHC was HER2-3 positive. He was subsequently treated with erdafitinib. This provided disease control for approximately 12 months. The recent imaging now demonstrates multiple new bone lesions in pelvis and spine. His performance status is 1, and he reports some mild lower back pain, which is easy to control with analgesic therapy. For this patient, I wanted to discuss whether immunotherapy rechallenge could be considered for patients who received immunotherapy in adjuvant setting, and what patient profile would you think represents the immunotherapy refractory disease after completion of adjuvant immunotherapy, whether it is the progression that happened while the patient was on adjuvant immunotherapy, or is it the same if it happened during adjuvant immunotherapy or progression happened 2 years afterwards? And does your approach change depending on the timing of the progression relative to the adjuvant immunotherapy? And do you re-challenge with immunotherapy in certain cases? Another question to consider specifically in this case is the sequencing of FGFR3-directed therapies and HER2 ADCs.
So let's start out first with this question. It's, again, coming up all the time now in oncology. After GU ASCO, even more people are going to be seeing IOs neoadjuvantly or adjuvantly. Any thoughts about how you think through the use of IOs in metastatic disease or recurrent disease in patients with prior IOs?
Yeah, so this is a great question and one that has been addressed, unfortunately, not clearly in urothelial carcinoma, but in renal cell cancer, where we know that immunotherapy after immunotherapy does not appear to be effective based on two studies, the CONTACT-03 and TENEVO-2 studies in renal cell. Whether that paradigm could be applied to urothelial carcinoma, we don't know. There is some data suggesting that it is different in the metastatic setting as compared to the immunotherapy, that is, rechallenge after progression on adjuvant therapy may be better to consider immunotherapy as compared to rechallenge in the setting in those patients who progress on metastatic disease. I think in this case, you know, if I have a patient who progresses on immunotherapy, I would be reluctant, even in the adjuvant setting, to continue them on additional or different immunotherapy, even in combination. So I would treat a patient like this if they were a candidate for enfortumab vedotin with enfortumab vedotin monotherapy rather than enfortumab vedotin in combination with pembrolizumab. Or at least I should say that's what I have been doing in practice. I think that what that timeline looks like, I think if you have someone, as was suggested, recurs 2 years, I think that that's different. I don't know that it's different, but would consider the use of immunotherapy at that time. Whether 6 months, whether it's a year, whether it's 2 years, I think we really just don't know that answer. I think, you know, clinical practice, I think, you know, a lot of us are thinking at 6 months or at 12 months to reconsider the use of immunotherapy. The truth is it has to do with how dramatic the responses are to enfortumab in combination with pembrolizumab. And so I think that that's been my experience. And I think in speaking with others, it's consistent with what folks are doing as well.
So two other aspects of this case she brings up. One is related to biomarkers. As that's why I said this patient really is really a cool example of how things are changing. So one question would be, when do you do any type of biomarker assessment? Obviously, we have FGFR as a possible target. We have HER2. You can tell me whether there are any other targets, whether you look at PD-1 levels, et cetera. And when you do this, do you do it in the localized setting? Do you wait till they have metastatic disease, tissue, liquid, both? Any broad approaches to biomarker assessment, urothelial bladder cancer?
Yeah, no. So another excellent point. You know, the truth is that, you know, PD-L1 has not panned out as a useful biomarker in urothelial carcinoma. There's a lot of reasons for that. The ways in which the trials have been designed and the integral biomarkers incorporated, the specific PD-L1 assay that's used, the antibody clone, the scoring systems, all of these sort of things have sort of confounded our ability to use PD-L1 as an effective integral biomarker. Now, with regard to next-generation sequencing, the truth is we send off NGS, but there's really one and only one actionable molecular alteration that we actually use to guide treatment decisions, and that's alterations within FGFR3, as was done here with an R248C mutation, and erdafitinib is a very appropriate option under the circumstances. And then more recently, HER2 by immunohistochemistry using the gastric scoring protocol based on the tumor agnostic indication in the Destiny Pan-Tumor02 study. And so those are really the biomarkers that we are using currently in the disease outside of there are additional markers that are being used in the setting of, you know, obviously clinical trials or off-label use of certain agents. But that is really the story to date in the treatment of patients with advanced urothelial cancer. When do I do it? I do it generally in certainly the metastatic setting. You know, will I do it in patients with, you know, high-risk muscle-invasive disease post neoadjuvant therapy who have persistent, you know, muscle-invasive disease or are high risk for developing metastatic disease? I think it's certainly reasonable, but absolutely in the setting of metastatic disease, get NGS and also HER2 by IHC.
So it's really interesting what's going on in oncology now with so many biomarkers. We're doing a program yesterday on ovarian cancer. We had a patient who was FR alpha positive and HER2 positive. So they have an ADC, mirvetuximab or T-DXd. Here, as in this patient, you've got FGFR and IHC 3+, so erdafitinib or T-DXd. She chose to go with erdafitinib. The patient was on for a year, which is not too bad, I guess. But how do you make that decision in terms of assuming you could access both? What comes first?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the decision was the right decision. You know, the level of evidence is higher for the use of erdafitinib. It's based on a randomized phase 3 clinical trial, the THOR trial, which looked at erdafitinib in patients who progressed after immunotherapy and chemotherapy, demonstrating an improvement in survival as compared to second-line therapy. And that was in 260-plus patients. When you look at the tumor-agnostic indication for T-DXd, that is a small group of patients. There's only, I think it was 16 patients in the urothelial cancer cohort with HER2 3+ positivity. And that's the indication. And so, you know, in this setting, I think you have to go with the randomized phase 3 data, and that would be erdafitinib.
So one more question. We could spend a long time talking about it, but maybe just give us a capsule summary of what you say to a patient who's about to begin erdafitinib. How do you and your office prepare the patient to receive erdafitinib? And what are you looking at over the first, you know, few weeks of treatment and ongoing in terms of key issues to be looking at for toxicity?
Yeah, it's a great point because, as you know, erdafitinib is not an easy drug to give. It's an oral drug, and I explain to patients first and foremost, just because this is an oral drug and not an intravenous one doesn't mean that it's necessarily easier. I mean, the things we look at, obviously, are hyperphosphatemia, which, as you know, is a PKBD biomarker for erdafitinib based on its mechanism of action, and that is actually used to make decisions about dose escalation. The other things we look at are mucosal toxicity, skin toxicity. Patients can have diarrhea. Patients can have nail toxicity. They can have onycholysis, onychomedesis. They can have nail infections. And these can be quite complicated to manage in addition to just fatigue, asthenia, and really require very close monitoring. There can be ophthalmologic complications with CSR and retinal pigment epithelial detachment, so they need regular ophthalmologic examinations. And so we are really on top of this in the clinic in having discussions with patients, outlining all of the potential toxicities that can occur. We have to monitor their, again, you know, phosphate levels closely, and we make sure that they bring any of these sort of mucosal skin toxicity, nail toxicity manifestations to our attention as soon as possible. Also go through a lot of preventive measures with the patients, you know, things as simple as wearing gloves, you know, avoiding sort of, you know, heat exposure. All of these kind of things are incredibly important in talking patients through the potential toxicities of erdafitinib.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next case. This is from Dr. Brown, an 88-year-old man.
This is an 88-year-old patient of mine. He had many years ago localized prostate cancer. He got primary radiation therapy and then developed muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And this was without a prior history of non-muscle-invasive disease. He presented with hematuria, got some scans, had hydro, had T3 disease, and had a unilateral nephrostomy tube placed. He got a TUR. It was UC, had some squamous and clear cell features, but it was still UC. And he went to the surgeon. He's fit, but he's still 88 and probably has less reserve. So he said, you're not a candidate for cystectomy. With his prior pelvic radiation, chemo radiation wasn't a great option. And so he and I talked about how do we preserve quality of life while also keep this at bay. And we did single agent Pembro beginning in 2023. And nine-ish months later, he had growth of disease, both in the bladder and lymph nodes outside the bladder. So at this time, he had CKD. Again, the priority for him was, I live a good life, keep it that way. And so I was hesitant about platinum doublet chemo, and I decided to start a dose-adjusted EV for him. He was probably on it for 5 or 6 months. He developed increasing fatigue, increasing anemia, and peripheral neuropathy in that 1.2 to 2 grade area. So we decided, okay, let's hold it and see what happens. This was in 2024. It's now been a year and a half later. He has no evidence of disease. His scans were last week. They look great. And so I'm just watching him with surveillance. My questions are, we used to talk a lot about cisplatin eligibility and carboplatin eligibility. So if you don't think someone is fit enough for platinum, are they fit enough for EV? Obviously for him, I gambled and I said, yes, I think he is. And he's really functional, drives, does all this stuff, but I still worry about that decreased reserve. So I was scared though. Maybe I should have started at 1.25. I started at 1. How would you approach that? The chemo candidacy versus EV candidacy? I think in his situation, I again made that decision that I'm going to use EV monotherapy because he's had clear progression on a checkpoint inhibitor. Would you have done that? Or would you have done EV plus pembrolizumab, hoping for some synergy between the two and just added the EV to his prior regimen? For him, I decided on EV monotherapy because he wasn't a cis candidate. Had he been a cis candidate and his creatinine clearance was 70 and he was a mover and a shaker and maybe 20 years younger, should I have chosen GemCis? And how does that sort of cisplatin eligibility play into your decision-making when you're deciding on platinum doublet versus EV monotherapy? This sort of, you're looking down these two pathways of, is this, am I going to break him? And that when he looked me in the eye and he said, Jackie, I trust you to take good care of me and to help me preserve my quality of life, am I about to decimate that? And here we are, he's 2 years, you know, kids, grandkids' birthdays, great-grandkids' birthdays, like, this is the promised land, but I would be just as anxious to make the same decision if the clinical situation arose again.
So any thoughts about this? I thought it was an incredible case. I mean, we forget that EV by itself as an ADC is very effective. Of course, paired with an IO with Pembro seems to be even more so, but I guess in the old days, or even nowadays, people are going to have IOs, and or they may not be eligible for IOs, and I don't know how often you see a response like this. And also, but of course, obviously here, the issue of being 88, you know, apparently pretty healthy 88, but still 88. Any thoughts about this case?
Yeah. You know, I think that this raises this whole question of, you know, infortimab vedotin just being, you know, just sort of an exceptional treatment in this disease. You know, even as monotherapy in the EV301 study, response rates of 45%, you know, improvement in survival outcomes. I mean, this is what this drug does. You know, in terms of this whole question of cisplatin eligibility and EV eligibility and the potential overlap, you know, I mean, we're familiar with the Galsky criteria, the issues of ECOG performance status and renal function and heart failure and neurotoxicity and hearing loss and these sort of things. I mean, there's certainly overlap, right? I mean, performance status is important for infortimab vedotin. Peripheral sensory neuropathy and motor neuropathy overlap with, you know, potential cisplatin effects. You know, there was an attempt to sort of look at this. There was this AVITA criteria that was put forth, looking at other things like hyperglycemia and ocular issues, included performance status and renal function. You know, I think that most folks were not too enthusiastic about using those criteria. I think this is quite different. I mean, again, I think the robustness of the responses and outcomes that we're seeing for patients are really, you know, very, very different than what we saw with cisplatin and certainly carboplatin-based chemotherapy. So I don't sort of look for reasons to not use infortimab vedotin either alone or in combination with pembrolizumab. But I do think things like, you know, certainly underlying grade 2 neuropathy is a big one. Uncontrolled diabetes, you know, is potentially an issue. If a patient has a very poor performance status, I mean, sure. I mean, palliative care may be more appropriate. But I don't think, again, we should necessarily be using certainly those specific criteria to make decisions about the use of enfortumab at this time.
So I was just reflecting that in December, we always go to San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. We again had a bunch of cases of people presented. We had a 103-year-old woman with metastatic breast cancer presented who actually was apparently taking care of herself, pretty good condition. They treated her. She responded. And you know, it just brings up this issue of, you know, the very elderly. I don't know how often you see patients in their 90s, for example, maybe even without comorbidities. How do you approach dosing? For example, if you're going to use EV Pembro or EV alone in a very frail patient who wants to be treated, but you're very nervous, maybe they got some chronic renal disease, how would you start low? How low?
Yeah. So renal disease is really not the issue as much with enfortumab, fortunately. I mean, there's data even suggesting, you know, safety and, you know, more importantly, efficacy. Well, I shouldn't say more importantly, but as important, efficacy in patients with severe renal dysfunction. You know, there has been some data suggested of sort of increased exposure during the first two cycles. Dan Petrylak initially presented this associated with higher response rates, but regardless of what dose, there was still improvement in the time to event endpoints of progression-free and overall survival with EV. So there is some data suggesting that exposure during the first two cycles, that is using the 1.25 mg per kg, may be important. That being said, again, you know, that's great when you look at, you know, sort of a research study or look in the context of a clinical trial. But once again, it's that patient that's sitting in front of you. It's sort of the art of medicine. It's the experience that you develop over time caring for people. And so I think that, you know, very appropriately in this case, dose reduction up front, yes, you may lose some of that response, but it looks like we'll not lose some of the important time to event endpoints. And so for this person, survival is different than someone who is, you know, in their 50s and their 60s and their 70s. And so I do absolutely consider upfront dose reduction in appropriate patients, those that I think are appropriate for a dose reduction, acknowledging that we shouldn't do it across the board. There is data suggesting that there is an exposure-response relationship, and that is something that occurs or is more important early, again, within those first two cycles.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Malowski, and thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Neil Love for Rapid Case Review.